It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state capitol report is ahead, but first, a 13-year-old Wisconsin girl who was kidnapped in October is with her family. Jamie Kloss was missing for 88 days before she escaped from her kidnapper. Kelly Englehart is her aunt.
Every single day, we had people approach us, talk to us, call us, text us, email us. Every single day, their support for Jamie. So when you have support like that, you can't but hope for the best because you don't want to let other people down.
WPR's Rich Kramer talked with Jamie Kloss's family. He's a reporter based in Eau Claire, and he spent the weekend with people in the community where her parents were shot and killed and where she vanished from her home. Good morning, Rich. How is Jamie Kloss doing?
Well, the last we've heard, she's doing well. She was treated for a brief period after escaping on Thursday. On Friday, the sheriff of Barron County said that she had been released from the hospital and that she was being reunited with her remaining family. And on social media, we've seen a lot of pictures of her with one of her aunts, and it's been really heartwarming to see. She's smiling, and she's safe.
What do we know about the 21-year-old Wisconsin man who's accused of kidnapping her and killing her parents?
Well, we're hoping to learn more today, but 21-year-old Jake Thomas Patterson is from the Gordon, Wisconsin area. That's in Douglas County, around 70 miles north of the home where the parents were shot and where Jamie was abducted. So he doesn't have a criminal record of any kind. But the sheriff did say that he does have a connection with Barron, although he did not elaborate on that. One of the things that has been reported is that he worked at the Jenny O Turkey store, which is one of the largest employers in Barron. But that was for a very short period of time, and that was 3 years ago. So the sheriff has said that he doesn't think that there's any ties between this 21-year-old and the Kloss family, but there is some connection with Barron.
We learned Jamie Kloss was alive and safe on Thursday. She escaped from the house where she was held, found neighbors to help her. How are people processing this news that she decided to run and try to save herself?
Well, people in the Barron area they were just beside themselves on Thursday night. I heard a lot of stories. It seems like some of the family and a lot of the community members were at a high school basketball game, and the announcer came on and told everyone that at 4 p.m. on Thursday, Jamie Kloss was found and that she is alive. And I heard that that place was, it was a surreal experience. Everyone, you know, the whole game stopped and people were, it just exploded with cheers and tears. So people have been giddy. I mean, they've just been excited. I've heard that word like three different times talking with people up there. They're feeling safe again. For a long time, they were uneasy because there wasn't a suspect named.
Tell us about a man you met named Dan Shullow.
Yeah. Dan Shullow and his wife, Diane, are dairy farmers. They live in Cumberland, which is right down the road from Barron. I met them at Seasons Cafe in Barron, and they've got three daughters of their own, but they were just very, he was really impressed with, you know, the fortitude that it took for Jamie to escape her captor.
One way or another, she found an opportunity, and you got to really give it to her for keeping her head, because she's seen an opportunity after all these days, and she took it. And she made it.
Yeah.
We're very proud of her for having that kind of constitution to be able to do that.
So you found out that Dan had never met the Kloss family, and yet we heard him say he's proud of Jamie. It sounds like he's talking about a family member.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon. I don't know if it's because it's, you know, a small town. It's the city of 3,300 people, but everyone kind of treated her and talked about Jamie as if she was a daughter of their own. It was really something to see.
How far apart are these communities, Barron, where Jamie Kloss's family lived, and the place where her kidnapper kept her?
just over an hour apart, 70 miles, I believe. And it's, you know, they're very, very different. I mean, Barron is pretty rural, but it's got a little bit of a, you know, there's some manufacturing there, so it's a little bit more urban. But Gordon, I actually played Little League there. It's a town of 600 people, and it's basically a lot of cabins, a lot of retired folks living out in the rural setting. And so it's something that was not on the radar of law enforcement, too. They've mentioned that this gentleman and this location didn't even cross their mind until Jamie freed herself.
Rich Kramer is with us. He's WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. We're talking about the Jamie Kloss situation and her ability last Thursday to get away from the person who had kidnapped her, who had allegedly killed her parents on that October night, October 15th. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, with your thoughts on this situation. Rich, you also talked to Larry Johnson, is one of the people who say the toll of this murder and kidnapping took on Barron. What did Larry Johnson tell you?
Well, Larry basically said that for the past 88 days, almost 3 months, the whole city was on edge. They were uptight. Larry was a previously a fire chief. He grew up in Barron, lived his whole life there. But he said that people were nervous. They were nervous because there was no suspect and there was no major breaks in the case. So they were really on edge.
You won't be looking in your garage and looking around. You'll be able to go to work and perform your duties. Perform your duties around the city, whatever you have to do. You won't be looking, thinking someone's going to come behind you with a gun or whatever it may be, you know.
So it sounds like there's been quite a bit of trauma here.
Definitely, and parents especially. I've heard numerous accounts of parents, you know, not letting their kids stand alone waiting for the bus for school. There's just something, and also another thing that I heard a lot of is this isn't supposed to happen in Barron. You know, people were telling me that they hear about this happening in bigger cities, but it's not supposed to happen in a small, close-knit community like Barron, is what they were telling me.
And we still don't know in any way how this kidnapper had connection to the Kloss family. Is there anything out there?
If there is, the Sheriff's Department, FBI, and State Division of Criminal Investigation have kept it pretty close to the vest. Today, the criminal complaint will come out after the 3:30 court hearing, which is an initial appearance for Patterson. I'm hoping to get some more details on that. I think the community's hoping for the same because the unanswered questions, they're happy that Jamie's home, but there's still a lot of unease about how he did this, why he did this. The one thing I can say is that Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald of Barron County said that they have been able to find no contact on social media between Patterson and Kloss or Patterson and Kloss's parents. So it's a real mystery.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for your work as the story unfolds. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter in Eau Claire. He joined us from the studio there to talk about the community reaction as 13-year-old Jamie Kloss was found alive last week. She was missing for nearly 3 months, and the man accused of killing her parents and kidnapping her will appear in court this afternoon. Stay with us on the morning show. Up next, it's the State Capitol Report. This is the Ideas Network. Republican lawmakers continue to hold power in both legislative chambers, but Republicans will not have a member of its party in the governor's office for the first time since 2011. We're talking about the first week of Governor Tony Evers' administration on this edition of the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The floor period of the new legislative session starts tomorrow. The floor period is identified in the legislative session calendar as the time available for consideration of proposals by the full Assembly and Senate. Republicans in the state assembly said last week there are a number of areas where they can work with Governor Evers during the session, but their leaders also identified some limits on where they're willing to flex with his campaign proposals. Laurel White is keeping an eye on all of this. She is WPR News' state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So 1 week into this new era of state government and feels like we're kind of off to the races. How would you characterize the last week?
Well, it was a busy first week for the Evers administration. We, of course, it was just a week ago today that we had the inauguration, and we had speeches from all the incoming elected officials to kind of lay out the groundwork for what they wanted to do in office. We had responses from the leaders of the two legislative chambers. So there was kind of an interesting dynamic there to see how leaders were talking about working together. And then Governor Evers traveled around the state, kind of outlining some of his big priorities over the next 4 years during the week, a little preview.
Well, let's start with the Affordable Care Act. He called last week for a change in direction in a federal lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. Can you bring us up to speed on what this lawsuit is in the first place?
Mm-hmm. So former Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel filed this lawsuit in early 2018, and it essentially challenges the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act in the wake of the individual mandate being changed, the tax law changing that. So that lawsuit is moving forward. When that was filed, Wisconsin was actually one of the leads on the lawsuit with the state of Texas. Governor Evers campaigned on removing Wisconsin entirely from that lawsuit, just not be involved anymore. But due to some changes during the lame duck session, he's not able to do that without approval from lawmakers who are unlikely to do so. So he said last week that he wants to change the stance of the state in the lawsuit, which is not obviously removing it entirely, but he's kind of attempting to work within that new framework that lawmakers created for him.
So Evers campaigned on ending Wisconsin's involvement, and he's not currently trying to do that. Is that right?
Right. It's a lot more difficult for the governor to do what he campaigned on doing, because under the new law approved during the lame duck session, it has any change to the state's involvement in a federal lawsuit has to be approved by the state budget committee, which is controlled by a large majority by Republicans in the state legislature who want to continue to be involved in the lawsuit. So there's kind of a new barrier there for him that makes it more difficult and quite unlikely, frankly, for the state to leave that lawsuit entirely.
Talking with Laurel White, she's WPR's state capitol reporter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your assessment of the first week of the Evers administration? What questions do you have about the latest state political news? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Laura, let's take a look at that lame duck session of the legislature. A group of plaintiffs filed a lawsuit in Dane County Circuit Court last week, and the suit aims to overturn all of the measures Wisconsin Republicans passed last month. What do we know there?
So this is an interesting approach that I wasn't aware of anybody talking about in the lead up to this lawsuit being filed. During the lame duck session and immediately after, there had been discussion about challenging some of the things that were passed in court on a variety of different grounds. Maybe they were violations of executive power or the balance of powers, things like that. Essentially, what this particular lawsuit is doing, though, is challenging the extraordinary session all on its own and saying that it was essentially not within lawmakers' power to call an extraordinary session, and so everything done within it should be invalidated because those powers aren't prescribed to them in the state constitution. The governor and his ability to call a special session is in the constitution, but not the extraordinary. So this is an interesting argument that they're making that would throw out basically everything that happened, not the specific laws and arguing why the specific things were wrong.
What are you hearing about whether or not this case could succeed in court?
Well, what's interesting about cases, Kate, is that, you know, you get a ruling and then you get an appeal and you get a ruling and you get an appeal. So regardless of what this first ruling, whatever side it comes down on, this case isn't going anywhere anytime soon because it's very certain to be appealed to a higher court. So this is an argument that's going to be vetted by a number of courts in Wisconsin over several months to come, if not years.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the new state legislature. It sounds like there's a joint meeting of lawmakers tomorrow with Governor Evers.
Mm-hmm. So this is something that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told us about last week. And he said that this is something that he, at least in his tenure in the state legislature, hasn't happened, which is Republican senators and Republican assembly members sitting down with the governor to kind of talk about priorities and talk about what they want to do in this upcoming legislative session, maybe try to iron out some areas of disagreement. So it's going to be an interesting meeting to talk to leaders and the governor about when it's over. It's not going to be open to the press, but I'm certain we'll have a lot of questions when they emerge from behind closed doors about what they talked about and what, if any, areas they're looking to move forward on early on in this session.
And Assembly Speaker Voss said lawmakers, GOP lawmakers, delivered this letter to the governor's office last Thursday outlining some potential areas of common ground. Where do you see Republican leaders think there is room for working together?
So that could be a little bit of a preview, actually, of what they talk about in that closed door meeting and what we might get some details about after. Assembly Republicans said that they believe they could work with the governor on things like transportation funding in Wisconsin, coming up with new ways to pay for road projects, potentially an income tax cut in the state, things like fighting homelessness and lowering the cost of childcare in Wisconsin, making childcare more affordable. They talked a little bit about groundwater and protecting the state's groundwater. So they laid out a number of things that they believe to be bipartisan, things that they pointed to the governor mentioning on the campaign trail. They also mentioned, of course, education funding, which is obviously something that the governor, the former state school superintendent, is very interested in and engaged with. So the governor's spokesperson responded to that letter by saying that he looks forward to working with Republicans. They kind of characterized that as a change of heart on the part of Republicans reaching out with these ideas.
Governor Evers also spent part of his first week in office touring Lincoln Hills, the state's troubled youth prison that is slated for closure. What was the significance of that visit?
So that was a significant visit because that was something that Governor Walker did not do, that a number of groups had kind of pushed him to do. A number of advocacy groups, organizations, even some fellow Republican lawmakers had pushed the governor to visit Lincoln Hills. Of course, Lincoln Hills had been in the news frequently, allegations of abuse and neglect of inmates. And Governor Walker declined to visit that and other correctional institutions in the state. So Governor Evers said during his campaign that he would visit Lincoln Hills. He said that he'd make it a priority. And he did, in fact, he posted on social media talking a little bit about his visit on Friday. He was able to make that visit on Friday and meet with some staff there.
We also learned last week about what's next for former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. What's on his docket in the near future?
So Governor Walker is moving to Milwaukee, and we know that he is continuing to be engaged in politics. He's transitioned from his Governor Walker Twitter account to the Scott Walker Twitter account, but he's been pretty active weighing in on national political issues, and he has said to reporters, I believe he told the Associated Press this first, that he's not ruling out another run for office sometime in the future. So I think Governor Walker is still certainly going to be engaged in Wisconsin and national politics, even though he's not going to be sitting in the governor's office.
And what are you going to be watching for in the week ahead?
So it's going to be an interesting week, perhaps not as as interesting as last week. We had so much going on, but I'm afraid to say that. You never know. We have some legislative hearings this week on some proposals in the Capitol. So we're getting down a little bit more into kind of the nitty gritty lawmaking process of this legislative session, with hearings and testimony and debate on specific bills.
Well, Laurel, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter. Up next, it's news. Then Wisconsin schools don't get much guidance from the state on how to help dyslexic students. We learn about the condition and hear how expected legislation could help schools get better assist students that live with it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the Mayo Clinic, signs of dyslexia can be difficult to detect, but some early clues may point to a problem. Once a child reaches school age, their teacher may be the first to notice. Dyslexia is a learning disorder characterized by difficulty reading, and Wisconsin is one of a handful of states without laws outlining how schools should help students with dyslexia. But that could change. A committee has recommended the legislature create a position within the Department of Public Instruction to hire a dyslexia specialist. We continue our State Capitol report now with Tammy Tillotson. She is outgoing president of the Wisconsin chapter of the International Dyslexia Association. She's also the center director of the Children's Dyslexia Center of Upper Wisconsin and a consultant for school districts across the state. Tammy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning.
So when people think about dyslexia, they may think it means reading words out of order, mixing up letters, but that is not the whole picture. Can you tell us more about this condition?
Yeah, I sure can. So the most common myth about dyslexia is that it is seeing words or letters backwards, and the reality is that dyslexia is not a visual problem at all. It is a language-based learning disability that is neurological in how individuals process the sounds and symbols within our language. So it is all neurologically based. It's how the brain is processing the language.
How common is dyslexia?
Well, according to the most common research science-based studies, dyslexia affects as much as 20% of the population, or as many as 1 in 5 kiddos or 1 in 5 individuals. So it is far more prevalent than what most individuals suspect.
And this is a lifelong issue. What are the early signs that a child might be dyslexic?
Well, there are a lot of characteristics that parents and educators can look for to help identify or do some early screening of dyslexia. Some simple things such as memorization of the alphabet, directionality issues, so even something as simple as tying their shoes, being able to follow all of those instructions of those bunny ears. Also, you know, getting into more complicated things such as phonological processing, which would be rhyming or word division, addition of sounds, letters. And then certainly as they become readers, understanding how the language is structured and being able to predict spelling patterns when they're not able to. Those are all red flags to look for.
How do you diagnose it?
Well, interestingly enough, dyslexia is one of those more challenging things. People suspect is more challenging to diagnose, only because it's a little bit of a battery of assessments rather than one full assessment that can simply diagnose. So typically in Wisconsin, the diagnosis of dyslexia comes through a psychologist or a neuropsychologist, and if we're working with kiddos, oftentimes that is going to be a pediatric psychologist or a pediatric neuropsychologist, and they're going to do a cognitive assessment typically along with a battery of educational assessments, and they're going to be looking at rapid automatic naming, phonological processing, a child's ability to read and spell words in isolation. They're going to look at comprehension pieces, both auditory and non-auditory comprehension, to see how a child is able to process what they're reading and where their struggles are. So a really good assessment is going to encapsulate a lot of different pieces that are going to really drill down into a child's knowledge and be able to understand where the strengths are and where their weaknesses are. But then the outcome of that assessment is not the actual diagnosis of dyslexia. It really is the reporting that comes out with that diagnosis of what interventions or what best practices can be put into place to best support that child in school and at home.
We're talking with Tammy Tillotson, who is outgoing president of the Wisconsin chapter of the International Dyslexia Association. She's also center director of the Children's Dyslexia Center of Upper Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a child who is dyslexic? What do you have to get for your child to help them in, with what they need in school? And do you often have to go outside of the school for help? What's that experience been like? Perhaps you are dyslexic but didn't get the help you needed when you were in school. How are you doing? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tammy, how do Wisconsin schools fall short when it comes to educating dyslexic children?
Well, unfortunately, you know, teachers go into the field of education with all of the best intentions and really doing everything right based on what they know. But unfortunately, they're not coming into the field of education as prepared in reading instruction as they could be. The majority of practitioners really haven't been prepared in a sufficient depth in order to prevent reading problems or to recognize the early signs of risk or really even to be able to teach students with dyslexia or, you know, that students that have dyslexia or other related learning disabilities. So when we look at the big picture of teacher preparation, you know, the International Dyslexia Association has done some research around teacher prep programs, and what they have found is that there is a huge absence in rich content and academic rigor in many of the courses that teachers are taking in preparation to become teachers. And once they're in the field, the professional development isn't always there to be able to support them. There are a lot of really great curriculums out there that teachers can put into place, but if they don't have the skills in order to use best practice methods for implementing those curriculums, then we really aren't doing full justice to our students in Wisconsin. The other thing that the International Dyslexia Association has found is that all of the tests that are aligned with scientific research aren't necessarily aligned with the teacher prep program. So Wisconsin has done a wonderful job at having the FORT exam, which is the exam that teachers have to take regarding reading instruction and other language issues once they are done with their prep program. But we have found that many teachers are having to take that test multiple times in order to pass, which is not an indication of the teacher's lack of, well, it is an indication of the teacher's lack of knowledge, but it's an indication more so of the teacher's lack of preparedness because of their prep programs. And that's not to say that all of the fault falls to the universities, because that is not the case, but that is the starting point that we have to start looking at. And all of this comes back to Wisconsin law. We have been lacking in legislation. When we look at other states that are light years ahead of Wisconsin, they have had best practices for certification, instruction, and preparedness for teachers that are having dramatic impacts with students.
So what do parents in Wisconsin currently have to do if their school isn't meeting the needs of their dyslexic child?
Well, unfortunately, it becomes a matter of, you know, parents really becoming their child's number one advocate. It's building relationships, but it's also learning everything they possibly can about the needs of their child, about dyslexia, and then being able to support staff within their child's school and, you know, helping them to understand how their child is going to learn best, what are best practices for an individual with dyslexia. And ultimately, it really does become a matter of awareness and education. So parents have to arm themselves with a lot of information and knowledge and be able to prepare that in a way that supports their child's teachers and their schools.
Do you find that they go out of their way to find their own tutors, their own reading specialists, their own programs that have developed up around schools?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's a high level of frustration from parents when they don't feel like their child is getting the support or accommodations or remedial instruction at school. And so parents do seek out those resources in the state of Wisconsin, and we are very fortunate to have a couple of really solid resources, you know, through the Children's Dyslexia Centers and through private practitioners across the state of Wisconsin that are highly credentialed. You know, I can speak on behalf of the Children's Dyslexia Center as far as being an accredited training program. So it has a high rigor and offers free tutoring for children who struggle with reading, writing, and spelling. And parents do seek out those resources because no one wants to see their child struggle. And that's the end-all of end-all is, you know, we want to help kids to become better readers. And we know that structured literacy or structured language that is more systematic, explicit, direct, that builds on, you know, the overall structure of the language and how it is formed, really is how our dyslexic kiddos learn really concrete rules and generalizations about the language and can apply them.
Tammy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate you including me in this conversation.
Tammy Tillotson is outgoing president of the Wisconsin chapter of the International Dyslexia Association. When we come back, we'll talk with Republican State Representative Bob Culp about this issue on the Ideas Network. Dyslexia is a learning disability in reading. Exact causes of dyslexia are still not completely clear. Kids with dyslexia have trouble reading accurately and fluently. They may also have trouble with reading comprehension, spelling, and writing. And now there's possible legislation coming up in Wisconsin to help school districts better support children with dyslexia. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in Republican Representative Bob Culp to the conversation. He represents the 69th Assembly District, which includes Stratford, and he chaired a bipartisan committee that's recommended the legislature adopt measures to better address the needs of dyslexic children in Wisconsin schools. Representative Culp, welcome to the Ideas Network.
And good morning, Kate. It's wonderful to join you, and especially to talk about this topic that I think is a very necessary topic to be discussing.
Well, you chaired this committee that looked at how schools could help children with dyslexia. What did you find?
What we found was that it seemed like we have a deficit in materials that give parents and sometimes teachers and administrators the ability to get their arms around this issue of dyslexia. So that really was the focus of the study committee, was to come up with how can we best put every school and every parent and every child and every teacher on kind of an even footing, give them a base level of information. There are schools that are doing a phenomenal job. The article in the Isthmus was talked about Madison doing, getting their teachers up to a certain level of understanding on this. And even like in Edgar, which is a municipality not far from here, in a school district not far from here, there's a teacher that's really grabbed the idea and is running with it. So what we did at the state was just to put a legislation out to put a guidebook in place to give a resource for teachers, parents, students, administrators to get their hands around this issue and to give them resources.
And I understand dyslexia really hits home for you.
Well, it does. I mean, my kids are all grown, and they're all very, they have jobs, and they're very well positioned for life. But so the youngest is 20 at this point. But certainly during their growing up years, we had 7 kids, and 3 of them were not diagnosed with dyslexia, but just had many of the symptoms of it. And my wife took charge of that and really said, okay, what do we need to do here? So it does hit home from a lot of different levels. I struggle as just a parent and a grandparent and a legislator to see kids that are left behind. These kids often are the best and brightest, and to get them frustrated when they're second, third grade because they've lost the ability to keep up with their classmates for something that really is, I think, rather easily fixed, to me just really pulls at my heartstrings. So it hits home on a lot of different levels.
Recommendations were made by your committee, and one would create a position within the Department of Public Instruction. What would this position look like? What would it accomplish?
Well, we put in place a criterion for that position so that it would be someone that would understand what dyslexia is and how to work with it, as well as how to work with school districts and give the resources. We didn't define the day-to-day activities of this position, but certainly I think it would be a good thing to have school districts and parents, when they have questions, not only have a guidebook, but have a go-to source at a DPI that would arm them with all of the things that they would need in order to teach in a way that is easily understood and easily gotten by the kids that are struggling. So, again, didn't define the day-to-day aspect of the job description, but put in place criteria, and again, just as a resource.
Tammy Tillotson earlier just described it as Wisconsin teachers just not fully prepared to tackle reading challenges. How does Wisconsin compare to other states in the area, in this area?
Well, we're way behind in terms of having any legislation dealing with dyslexia. And just to put it in a baseline, you may have heard this earlier. I only tuned in about 3 minutes before I got on board. But Wisconsin back in 1998-9 was third among the states in rank as far as reading proficiency at, I think, the fourth grade level. We've dropped to 33rd or 34th. Now, our scores, kids' scores, student scores haven't declined, but other states have done some more creative things than we have. So it's time that we get on this, and I'm just delighted to have been a part of the process. It was a rigorous process, and really we had a lot of incredibly good debate. I'm hopeful that we can get this through, but we certainly are not leading the charge here. We're playing catch up.
Talking with Representative Bob Culp, who represents the 69th Assembly District, which includes Stratford, and he chaired a bipartisan committee that's recommended the legislature adopt measures to better address the needs of dyslexic children in Wisconsin schools. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How dyslexia has impacted your child or your life. Join in with your story, 800-642-1234. Representative Culp, are there plans to include measures that would hold schools accountable to make changes benefiting a dyslexic student?
We didn't go that far with the study committee. There were members on the study committee, which is not just legislators. Those study committees are made up of a wide variety of citizens and educators in this case. We didn't go any further than we did because you end up getting to the point where, as from the state's perspective, it is always difficult to have some kind of a mandate or an additional follow-up with school districts. We're hopeful that the guidebook will be the first step in hopefully a lot of good reforms that will happen at the school board and local school district level, as well as at the CESA level, and just get the conversation going. So we did not put any kind of parameters in place that way.
What's the timeline here? When will this legislation be introduced?
We expect it to be the report and the legislation to be done by the Legislative Council, which is the nonpartisan group that writes the laws for us and helps us out with committee work in the next month or so. And then from there, my guess is it will be voted on. I certainly hope it will. It'll go through the standard process, the committee process there. And if the legislation actually gets passed, I would like to see it be passed in the first 6 months of this year. And then from there, we have about a year for the committee to be formed and the guidebook to be put together and those types of things. So that's the timeline.
In writing this legislation, have you looked to any other state laws for guidance or inspiration here?
Oh, absolutely. There's so much work that's already done in other states that it was easy to bring in people to testify, as well as to look at best practices and having the National Council of State Legislators come in and talk about what's been done. So we would absolutely looked at many other states to try to mirror and mimic the best and to look at what didn't work and reject that.
What obstacles does it face, if any?
I would say the obstacles it faces would be simply that there are people that really like the way reading has been taught and are resistant to change, and that's said in a vague way, I know, but I believe that the bulk of people are saying we need to do something because the reading score rank has declined, and I think Wisconsin is ready.
Do you think you'll have the ear of Governor Evers, because he's come in from his past position as superintendent of schools, and now here he is the governor? Do you think that education will be more of a pressing issue here?
I certainly hope so. It's my intention to schedule a meeting with him now that the first week of his administration is behind him. Hopefully he'll have a mechanism similar to a previous governor that will allow for legislators to come in and talk about their ideas. Certainly hope he's on board. I'm going to make a persuasive case to him to be, because I believe in this, and I think that the kids in Wisconsin that will be benefited will really also appreciate it.
Representative Culp, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Bob Culp is a Republican who represents the 69th Assembly District, includes Stratford, and he chaired a bipartisan committee that's recommended the legislature adopt measures to better address the needs of dyslexic children here in Wisconsin. And earlier we talked with Tammy Tillotson, outgoing president of the Wisconsin chapter of the International Dyslexic Association. This is a State Capitol report, and we'll hear next about an upcoming rule changes in effect for hundreds of fire departments across Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network.